And he was mad. He was so mad. He was so mad. And I could see it in his face when he was driving around the block. He was really mad because I knew that this was, he was still coming for me.
So Elaine, you were the pork queen back in Iowa. In what year?
1981. Northeast Iowa.
You want to tell us the story of how you became the pork queen?
Well, I was in theater and such in high school, but it was my childhood sexual predator. He was a big pork producer and officer in that county's pork association, pork producers association. It was his idea. It'd been going on for 2 years, and it was his idea that I should run for queen. And it was kind of a joke among my friends because that was a time of Muppets and Miss Piggy. And I actually won. My dad was even not even a member. He joined as a small farmer so I could do this. And so, yeah, for a year, I was riding in the parades and handing out the samples of pork and the recipes and going to schools teaching kids about pork, always having to keep my eyes out for him because I didn't want him to jeopardize, you know, my professional position representing the county. But he was lurking always.
How'd you meet him?
He was the father of a family I babysat for. I was number three of six kids growing up on a farm in Northeast Iowa. Fabulous upbringing, wonderful parents, married 60 years, so much in love to the end when they died just months apart of each other in a nursing home in Des Moines, Iowa. And so I made a lot of money babysitting because I had experience and I was in 4-H and had done the babysitting courses. And he was the father in the family I babysat for. And it started when I was 16, approximately. Because I was learning to drive. And, you know, in the rural areas, the father usually, almost always, would pick you up and drive you to their place for the babysitting, and they'd drive you home at night. And sometimes they were really drunk. And anyway, one of the nights he was taking me home, we had a long lane, and he decided to stop the truck halfway up the lane and ask me if I wanted to practice driving, because I think I'd been babysitting for a little before that. And so I was like, yeah, sure. And I even... stupid. So I was going to jump out of the cab and go around to the driver's side. This was at night. And he convinced me, no, just climb over him in the cab. So, of course, I didn't feel right, but I did. And then he just started groping me and just, I don't remember everything. But thankfully, my older brother was out that night partying, and he came up behind us, and his headlights stopped the assault. But immediately that man said, if I tell anybody or if I stop babysitting for him, he would hurt someone in my family. So, you know, he dropped me off. I think maybe my brother and he had words. I don't know. I ran in the house. But I never could tell anybody. So despite, you know, 2 years later being pork queen and all that time in high school, you know, A's and honor rolls and co-valedictorian at graduation, teaching CCD, trying to keep up the face. Everybody thought I was the kid that had it together, but God, the secrecy, it was a lot to carry. And it ends up, I found out later, the wife knew all along. She was the one that called for the babysitters. And later in college.
He was doing this to other babysitters?
Yeah, it wasn't just me. I found out later.
And what happened in the car, in your drive?
I just remember lots of groping and hands. I don't remember. The brother pulled up. The headlights stopped it. He dropped me off. But then from there on, anytime I babysat.
Oh, so you worked for him more than once?
I felt like I had to because he told me if I stopped babysitting or if I told anybody, he would hurt someone in my family.
Oh, wow.
So I kept babysitting.
And the sexual abuse continued?
It kept going. I mean, initially it was him forcing me to give him hand jobs or blow jobs, and I don't remember what he was doing to me, But it wasn't actual penetrative sex until a little later. I don't remember exactly when, and that was kind of degrading. I remember he drove us out to some woods somewhere, and it was a big pile of cut timber, and just leaned me, just bent me over the wood pile, and that's when I lost my virginity. Just like a, and I was like a, just a dog to him. I was just nothing.
Who was he in the
The father of this family, I've been except for.
And did he work? Did he have a farm? Did he?
Yeah. He was a big pork producer, and big farmer. He was a bigger farmer than my dad. My dad's farm, 160 acre, owned by my cousin now, was multi generational farm, settled by Liechtenstein ancestors in the 1880s. This guy was, I don't know if he ever got to like thousands of acres. Some of those farmers got very big. He was a farmer. And sometimes when the wife would call me to babysit, I found out later from my cousin, she was off cheating in the daytime. And she'd go off, hire us in the daytime. I say us, because now I know there's more victims. But me, I'd be there. And at that time, they only had one little child. Thank God, too young to know what was going on. But yeah, I never knew. She'd be off, and I'd be babysitting, like summers when not school, when no school was in session. I'd never know when he'd come in from the fields or the pig barn and just start molesting me in the house when the child was there napping. He's just a horrible person. And, yeah, I found out years later from her mouth, the wife's mouth, that, yeah, oh, because I went to the college where I got the full scholarship, small private school, less than an hour away, and he started stalking me on campus. He wasn't letting up on me. He started stalking me on campus, and I had to recruit the campus security to protect me. But again, I still wasn't talking about it to anybody, except for the security guys. I just said, this guy, you just got to protect me from him. And then I transferred to art school in Chicago for my last 2 years. And I was like, good, anonymity, a big city. I can finally be alone, left alone. Then I found out from my parents years later when they learned about this and why their daughter had been struggling in a family session, therapy session. That's when they learned about it. They said that they remembered when I was in Chicago, a guy would always call and pretend to be a friend of mine and ask when I was coming home from Chicago. And sure enough, one of my trips home from Chicago, he knew that on Saturday, late afternoon, I'd go to church because my family was very Catholic. If I was visiting, I always expect to go to church. And then, I'd go down to the river town to party or something. And my younger sister and I were coming out of church. And he was mad. He was so mad. He was so mad. And I could see it in his face when he was driving around the block. He was really mad because I knew that he was still coming for me. So I went to the county sheriff, and I was at art school in Chicago, my junior and senior year equivalent, credits transferring back to the 4-year degree. I went to the sheriff and I said, I need a restraining order. And I told them why, and they didn't believe me. They wouldn't give me a restraining order. And so I don't know what gave me courage, but I think I was just so desperate that I went to his farm. He had the farm he lived on, and then he had the farm, another farm where he had the pig operation. And I saw his truck at the pig operation barn. And so I went from the sheriff to his barn, and I said, I don't know if I lied and said I actually got a restraining order. No, I think I told him I tried, and they wouldn't, but I'm here to tell you, leave me alone. And then I was in art school in the 80s, the Madonna thrift shop, goth look, dancing in the back alley clubs, Depeche Mode and Psychedelic Furs. I had a look that didn't look common in this rural area of Northeast Iowa. So he just accused me of blackmailing him for drug money. That's why I was there confronting him. And then I called the wife. And I begged her, would you please tell him to leave me alone? Because I figured by then she knew. And that's when she told me. And that's why I hold her as responsible for myself and all the women, young girls he messed with. She just said, yeah, we were in marriage counseling. He's got a thing for babysitters. She knew all along. But it did stop after that. But that night when I was getting out of church, I could see he was mad because she must have told him about my phone call. And I told my sister, she still didn't know. I couldn't tell my siblings other than my two younger sisters. I just said, never babysit for this family. I couldn't tell them why, but thank God they listened to me because I didn't want them to be molested by him. But he was raging. He was driving around. I could see it in his eyes. I told my sister, get in the truck, and we flew down to this river town, maybe 8 miles away, on a 55-mile-per-hour two-lane highway. I was going like 100, and he was chasing me. It felt like 100, and my sister was like, didn't know what was going on. And the only thing I could think to do was go to my then-sister-in-law's father's home. He was a prominent surgeon, physician in that town. So I just ran to the doc's house, and my sister and I just hid out. And I couldn't tell them why I was there and who was chasing me. But they asked, should I call the police? And I was afraid of the police getting involved. So I just hid out in their home until I felt it was safe, and then we went home. And my sister still really had no idea what was going on until years later. And then it stopped. It did finally stop then. But that was the end encounter, and that was the scariest because I could see the anger. Just, you know, when he drove by and he looked at me, I could see it. So, yeah, he was scary, and it messed me up for life. And it makes me so sad, especially years later when the wife admitted it, and then other people, when I used to avoid going home. And I lived, you know, every part of the country and only visited family, you know, during holidays when I had to because I didn't want to run into him. But when I found out, it was confirmed, not just from the wife herself, but from others that, yeah, there were other girls. I don't know if this is 100% true, but I think it is. There was a young girl on the school bus because we rode buses into town for school. I remember her, you know, must have been like 4 or 5 years younger than me. She became one of his victims, and she killed herself. And so I don't even know how many others are out there, and if any others succumbed to the shame and the guilt and the fear like she did. And myself, I mean, there was a point I cracked in Chicago, and I tried to end it. And it was really because I was in art school and I was doing fabulous A's, and we were at the last semester preparing our portfolios, practicing interviews. I was prepared and wanting to work in Chicago, but I had a little studio apartment because the school was like several stories downtown. You know, I drove horse and carriage out of Water Tower Place to pay for my rent and my art supplies. But it was a studio apartment, one window facing a brick wall and cockroaches. When you turned on the kitchenette light, you know, it was not a great place. And I had a twin mattress on the floor. And I think all of the self-doubt and this feeling of, if you really knew me and you knew the secrets I carry for awful men like him, and there were many at the 2 years of college before I transferred to Chicago. Oh, my God, I must have had a target on my back. There was one fraternity, and the dean's son was the head of this whole group of guys. They just raped me again and again. I was a binge drinker. I didn't have any sense of a normal male-female relationship, and they kept trying to recruit me to be a little sister in their fraternity. That was the guys, but they'd just get me drunk and rape me. I mean, my sophomore year, my freshman year, I had a roommate. She kept having sex with her boyfriend, so I asked for my own room. I got my own room. One of those guys, this was the scariest, Mark. One of those guys who had a really, you know, a hot girlfriend. They were like the couple in this small private college. I don't know where she was, but he partied me up, took me back to my room, tied me up to my bed, hands each to the headboard, ankles to the footboards, raped me. And then left me, went to the party, left me tied up there in my dorm by myself. And I was probably drunk and, you know, in and out of consciousness. I don't know, just fear. I was terrified. The whole fraternity would just, and the sports team would just come in one at a time to rape me. They didn't, thank God. It was just him, and I think he came back one more time, and I don't remember. But then, so my sophomore year, I got a little apartment downtown, and they were still coming around. And I just didn't have boundaries, you know? I guess I was flattered by their attention. I don't know. But I remember one of those times, I woke up on the little, you know, tile floor of my tiny bathroom, just naked. Somebody had raped me and just left me there. I didn't even know which guy. So Chicago, transferring to Chicago was good because Chicago was good years. Nobody bothered me. But that last semester, when it was time to like interview and get out on my own, and I was going to live in Chicago, the walls closed in on me. A little tiny studio apartment, smaller than this. I remember chain smoking and thinking, I can't live with this. I'm just going to have to end it. And I started sneaking around, buying sleeping pill packs at different pharmacies. And I knew as a Catholic and a faith-based, you know, raised child from a good home that this wasn't right. But I couldn't carry the secrets anymore, and I couldn't live with it. So I remember I just quit going to school. They thought I was sick, but I was just up all night and chain-smoking and not eating and dwelling on this. I called a suicide hotline. A sweet old lady showed up in my studio with a Bible and prayed with me and left me the Bible, thank God. Because I still was going to do it. I just kind of felt like I needed a blessing or something. I don't know what I was thinking. But so I did it. I sat there on my twin floor mattress and I took all those pills. And I probably was chugging a beer and chain smoking. And then it happened. It started to happen. I had my hand on the ashtray flicking the ashes. And the ashes became spiders. And they just started crawling up my arm. The hallucinations as the pill were taking effect. They started crawling up my arm and I was freaking out. And I had my crucifix still from communion. And my Catholic brain, I was like, okay, if I can just get my eyes on my crucifix. And I couldn't. And the spiders. And so I drug myself on the floor to the bathroom somehow, I remember. Before I passed out, I don't remember who actually called the emergency room and got me to the hospital and pumped me and then sent me home, pumped my stomach and sent me home for therapy. But I crawled to the sink. I pulled myself up in the sink thinking if I can see the crucifix, I can be saved. The devil can't take me. And I did. I was able to crawl up, pull myself up on the sink. I saw the crucifix, but then I saw my face. The hallucinations were so scary. I was a skeleton. I was a skull. And it shocked me, but I saw the cross, I passed out, and I lived. And I'm grateful I did. And there were other points in my life, it would resurface again, I'd be fine, and then something would trigger me, or I'd get back to that feeling of, I'm not who you think I am. You think I got it all together, but you don't know me, and if you knew me. And so I would try again. There was some point I tried to hang myself. Thank God, like I said, thank God it didn't succeed because, I mean, I'm trying to live every day fullest now because at 63, I mean, I'm lucky if I got 40 years. I probably won't. But people that know of what I went through now still don't understand how hard it is. I never married until I was 40. I never even lived with a man until I was 40. But I did eventually have good boyfriends, you know, when I was working a commercial art and advertising in Indianapolis and when I was living in Lawrence, Kansas. I mean, there were some good ones other than the ex that I left now after 21 years. But it just, these predators. And the worst part was, let me know if I get off track, but the worst thing was I thought I was doing good about 4 years ago. 4 years ago, my older siblings were organizing a family reunion back, you know, where I grew up. And I had forgotten that this man's wife is a distant cousin. And her mom in the nursing home had gotten an invitation. She contacted my siblings and wanted to invite her and her husband to the family reunion. Like nothing had ever happened. And thank God, by then, my older siblings and all my siblings knew of his abuse. And they immediately called me on a little conference call, and they said, Elaine, we got to tell you what's going on. And they told me she contacted them and asked if they could come to the family reunion with their kids and everything. And, you know, my siblings were great. They were like, we got your back. We won't let them come anywhere near you. You should come. You got to come. There's a big family reunion. We haven't had one in years. But my husband was traveling at the time, and I was alone. And it was like, I thought I was better, you know, in and out of therapy, and my life was good. And all came up. I had an absolute panic attack. I was on the phone crying and pacing and freaking out because the mere idea, and I had planned to go to that reunion, the mere idea that he would be anywhere near me and that she would think it's okay to bring him around me. I mean, I said to my siblings, I was like, I can't go. I can't go. And they're like, no, we got
Did
you.
Did they
and
get invited?
Like, what?
Were they?
No, my siblings, I'm so thankful to them because they contacted her back and they said, you're not invited and you know why. And my brother, who had to have contacts with this man because he owned property near the timber my brother goes to all the time, and so he had to maintain a relationship with him to get access to his timber where he's building the cabin. He had words with him, and he just said, yeah, you're not allowed to come, and you know why. And the man just said, yeah. So I don't even know if he knew his wife was trying to invite him to this, but the audacity that she seriously thought, just because, oh, a bunch of years have passed, I guess, that she and he could just show up at the family reunion. Like, all that had never happened. But yeah, my siblings had my back. They were not invited. They did not attend. But I did not go either because I told him, I said, if he knows I'm in the area, he knows when, and he knows when the reunion is. The location of the reunion was just a few miles from where he lived in his new home. I said, he'll be stalking me again. He's obsessed. I can't show up. So no, I didn't go. They had me put the family reunion shirt on in a picture, and they photoshopped me in the family picture. Because no, I couldn't attend. But it just goes to show, after all those years when I thought I was okay and life was good again, because it would always be good for a while and then something, and then, oh God, and here we go again, and then I'd be good. It was good for years, other than not a great husband, but nothing else was bad. But just like that, it was all there again. And I just can't believe to this day that she thought that was going to be okay, to bring him around me, when she knew dang well, not only me, but other girls. And who knows, maybe this video, somebody that was a victim of his will see it, and maybe they'll do the civil lawsuit that I was thinking about
doing. Did his name ever come out?
What do you mean?
The guy who did this to you.
Come out in what way?
In any way.
Well,
You haven't even mentioned his name.
No, people will figure out who he is. I got the impression from my cousin who still lives in the area that people do know about this, about him being this kind of creep. But for some reason, nobody's holding him accountable. And I think all the girls like me were threatened into silence, and they're probably just trying to survive it like me.
It's crazy how we protect these guys.
I know. I still don't understand it. And the influence he still has in that community. And the fact that he, at one point, until recently, sat on the Iowa State Pork Producers Board representing our region. I almost, before he didn't either get reelected or didn't run, I was almost going to write a letter to the Pork Producers Association, that state one, and say, you need to know the man that sits on the board and who he really is. But I didn't, because again, I was thinking, oh great, then he'll come at me with a lawsuit for slander. But I just also never felt like it would be healthy for me to go back into that area and to lose a lot of money to lawyers and to have to face him. And surely he would have been a nasty person in court trying to fight to protect his reputation, because I was going to go after the wife and him. Because she knew, and she kept bringing us in there, that we young girls, knowing her husband was a predator and babysitter's worst thing. And like I said, the actual sex where he took my virginity didn't happen right away because I think there must have been some guilt. It didn't seem to get hard. And I was a kid. I didn't know what to do, but he was trying to instruct me what to do, but it never seemed to work. And I figured that was always a certain bit of guilt, now that I look back at it, that affected his abilities to. But when he did that, then it was all game, you know. Then it was just again and again. And thank God, I mean, I never got pregnant. I just don't understand. I don't understand people like this. And the people that know and protect him, like the wife and the other townspeople, because he should have been listed on the predator, what do you call that list? The predators, child predator list.
Yeah.
Way back in 1979.
Do you wish, looking back at your story now, do you wish you handled things differently?
Certainly. Definitely when I found out there were others. And that was a lot of guilt. Because...
This is in what town in Iowa?
It's a very small town of less than 1,000 people. And I lived in the country. The town I went to school in is Garnavillo. It's about 50 miles north of Dubuque, which is the biggest town most people know. So northeast Iowa. But yeah, I really wished I had done something or said something sooner, especially when I found out later there were other victims. Because if I had said something... Because, I mean, I was known, and my family's name, when they came up and settled that area in the 1880s from Liechtenstein, my father's ancestors brought in other family. They built that community. They were a well-respected farming family. And still, that name is prominent in that area and in Liechtenstein. But had I had the courage, yeah, I could have saved some other girls. I saved my sisters, though. I'm so glad they listened to me because I was so afraid he was going to come for them next because they were starting to make money babysitting, too. And I did think about it later when I ended up in therapy after my suicide attempt in Chicago when I was 21. That's when my parents found out. The therapist said, I think your parents need to come to session. And oh, gosh. A little later than when my parents were able to talk about it and they understood why their daughter was struggling off and on, you know. I said to them, I think I should take them to court. And they just felt like it would be too much for me, my mental health. I wasn't ready for it. And so I respected that. And plus, it's a small town. They had moved into town. They maybe sold it to my cousin, but maybe they didn't want to be involved in the drama. So I respected that. But that day, I'll never forget. My dad and my mom met when she was in nursing college and he was in the Air Force in Kansas. And then he went off for 4 years, you know, fixing planes during the Korean War in England. And then they started dating and she went and became a farm wife. And they were wonderful couples. And that's, I think, what got me through this, is I had a really good upbringing. And my grandma lived upstairs, his mom, and it was farm life. You know, I was outside watching birds then. I paint them now. I mean, that's what I think got me through it. I had a good foundation. But that day, my mild-mannered, kind, loving dad, that drive home from Dubuque, absolutely silent. As soon as we got back to the farm, I'd never seen him like this. He went right for the closet and got his shotgun. He was going to go shoot him. And I didn't know if he was going to kill him or just hurt him. But Mom and I had to talk him down and stop him from doing it. Ugh. And I think about it now. He was ready to go to jail for me. He was so mad at what that man had done to his daughter. And, you know, Mom and Dad and I had a good relationship up until they passed in 2016, and we were able, through many of my visits as a teacher, art teacher, I had summers off, my kid and I would go visit. And we had time to talk about that and talk about all of it. And I did thank Dad for having my back, but I would never have wanted my dad to go to jail. But that was his reaction. And then Mom and Dad just never spoke of him, well, unless we were having a conversation and processing. But if they ran into him or the wife during at town, they just avoided him.
How do you think this affected you as an adult?
Well, it definitely affected my relationships with men. Clearly in college, my first 2 years, I was a target. And it was passed around that, I guess, what was I labeled? Like, I suppose in guy terms, the slut, the easy one on campus. And so I was a victim there and a target there. So dating was hard because I didn't really have a sense of normalcy. And like I said, I was happy to be alone. Art, making, music, dance, once I found those underground dance clubs in Chicago where you could just dance. You didn't dance with anybody, you just danced nonstop. That got me through. Because I had a good foundation and I had a talent that I guess was God-given because I was a kid elementary showing a talent and then great art teachers. And it affected me in that, as I said, I could get professional jobs. I could present myself always as professional and on the ball and got it together, but then it would creep up. Something would trigger me, and then I'd be right back into a depression, self-doubt, low self-worth. And then I'd be right back to ideation of ending it, back in therapy, in and out like that. And it's always been an ebb and a flow. So it's just been hard. And so many people that know me on the surface level and admire my talent or buy my art or were parents of kids I taught art to. You know, I was K through 12 many years teaching art while I was painting and showing and selling. Never had any idea. So I always felt like a fraud. It's a fraud. Like all the acting I had to do as poor queen when, in fact, all this crazy stuff's going on. Same thing. I always felt like a fraud. And that any day somebody was going to find out, you know, my past if I didn't control the narrative. And so it affected me in that. It just made everything harder. It's just everything is harder. Because I could never, I mean, now I feel like I'm finally releasing it and I'm at peace and I'm living in a beautiful nature, intense location in a new state, and I've got good people around me and my pets and my music and my art and my hiking. And nature is my church, you know? I mean, now I feel like, okay, maybe 63, I'm finally in peace. But from 16 to just a couple of years ago with that reunion thing, oh my gosh, I was always like, okay, she's doing great, you know? And then crash. And people would be like, well, what's going on with Elaine? Or, oh, she's depressed. Or, oh, back in therapy. And so many people would judge and have no idea why I was struggling. Because it's never been an easy story to tell. And I rarely tell it to anybody. When I finally could talk around that Northeast Iowa area, and I learned people knew about him and weren't surprised, which horrified me, I still couldn't really share it with strangers. You know, new people you meet or at work, who wants to hear about that? Most people, it's too much. They can't handle it. And that's when I got labeled a lot. Oh, you're too much, or oh, you're crazy, or oh, you need therapy. Well, yeah, you would too. You would too if you had lived or walked a mile in my moccasins, and my mom had a little serenity prayer about not judging people unless they've walked a mile in their moccasins. And so true. I've always felt like, don't judge me. You have no idea what I've gone through. And those 2 years in high school and then those first 2 years of college, it was just awful. And it's hard because you stuff it in the back of your brain. You keep closing little doors in the back of your brain and you think you got it and you're okay. And then something opens a door and it's right back in the surface and you're struggling again. And as a result, my memory is terrible. everybody's like, you should write a book, a memoir, because my life has been crazy and good, in good ways and bad. But I always say, like, well, if I did, I'd have to be a half memoir, because I can't remember timelines or some of my own things. Even just recently, I was talking to one of my siblings, and she was sharing something that she remembered from us being together. That was just a wild time in Chicago, and I was like, I had no memory of it. And same with, you know, if I was to try to write out exactly what all went on in those 2 years that I was just his plaything, and whenever I showed up at the farm, his farm, I wouldn't be able to piece it together entirely. I mean, some of the things like the wood pile and the first encounter and the fear of I'm babysitting and I don't know when he's going to come in the house and start molesting me, and then the pork queen drama of trying to keep up appearances while he's lurking. And I was so terrified he'd even just come close to me and he'd display a body language that indicated there was something more between he and I. I was terrified somebody would see that. So I was like always, so I think it rewired my brain, honestly. I think it rewired my brain differently because I have the ability now, I guess I want to call it a superpower, from surviving. I can walk into a room, immediately read energies, pick out, you know, the fake ones, the potentially don't talk to that persons in the group. I'm always, you know, scanning for security because I've, you know, I'm back to being a single person. I've loved being a single person. I like living alone. If I want to blast music at 2 a.m. and paint, I can. You know, as an artist, sometimes you create whenever you want to. I like living alone, and I have a good little mini schnauzer guard dog. But trying to survive all that in high school, I think it has just made me, like I said, somebody who's got a radar now for bad people. And I can sniff them out. And sometimes they are tricky, though. Like the ex, covert narcissism, they're tricky. That was scarier almost than the guy in high school because they don't like to be unmasked. But I seem to have an ability now, I guess through surviving and learning and growing in therapy, to sniff them out. And recently, it's been kind of crazy. The masks are just falling off these ones around me. I'm like some trigger. They, in my presence, and I don't put up with anybody's BS anymore. And I hold up a mirror to you, and they just fall apart. And I'm just like, hey, that's a you issue, not a me issue. I'm doing my work. You do your therapy and stay away from me. But yeah, so in some ways, I mean, who would ever find any silver lining to my story? But in some ways, it did arm me with certain abilities to scan, screen, and protect my peace. Right now, it's all about protecting my peace. Honestly, I just want people to leave me alone. I just want to paint. I just want my music and my beautiful new location where I live, and I just want to be left alone. And it's all about protecting my peace and staying healthy mentally, physically, spiritually, so I can get good years now. And I'm not looking for a new man, God no, but I just pray to my parents who were such good partners to each other. Maybe there's some guy out there who's nice like that will actually treat me with respect and love me and not use me or abuse me in one way or another. So I don't care if that finds me or not. I just want to paint and be surrounded by good people and nature and just have some peace finally. And that's part of this. For me, this video is just releasing it. I just got to get it off. I've carried the weight of so many men's abusive secrets from high school to college to, well, others in inner circles. You know, I'm just tired of carrying the weight of their secrets, and they just act like everything's fine. Just, you know, stick their penis wherever they want. Doesn't matter the age. You just, and then go on with their lives. That's not right. And, but it's not for me to fix anymore. I'm not going to put money into civil lawsuits because lawyers, they eat that up quick. I found that out in the divorce when somebody lawyered up against me. So this video to me is release. I got a great therapist waiting for me I'm going to start working with. He knows I'm doing this video. And I was going to focus on painting, nature, birds is what I paint now. Birds and mammals that I see with my naked eye on some repurposed wood, and I had a little gold leaf and silver leaf and wood burning. It's much different formatting than canvases. I used to work as large as some of yours. So I'm happy now. I'm happy. I'm free of another bad man. I don't want any more. That doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, decide to be with women, but I just don't want bad men. I just want them to leave me alone. And it's like I feel like I'm a light and they're energy vampire moths, and they just find me. And then they suck the living light out of me. And I don't even understand it. If you're drawn to my outgoing personality or my energies or whatever, then why would you snuff out that which you admire in me that you don't have yourself? Why don't you grow with me and live like that? But no, I don't understand it. So I don't want to turn my light off because I'm free. I'm going to paint. I'm going to be out there. I've got a show in September I'm going to sell my paintings at. So I'm not going to stop. I mean, an artist never retires. But so I'm not going to dim my light. But my God, these types just need to crawl back under the rocks they belong under. And I'm praying a lot more for discernment because I still get fooled a few times. I think they're a good person, and thankfully they show themselves sooner than later. I think I'm getting better at picking up the red flags. And I had red flags with the ex-husband, but I didn't listen to him. Always listen to your gut. Oh, my God, always listen to your gut. I listened to friends and family that were like, oh, you can't let this one go. Because I used to date mostly artists and musicians and writer-type men, creatives, you know, with open hearts and souls. And this guy was, you know, very different, a business career person succeeding. And everybody thought, I was a single mom then, that, oh, think of the opportunities for a kid. It's like, well, what the heck? I was back at college for another degree. I was going for a master's in art education. I had an apartment, you know, for my kid and I. I had great support. My parents were great grandparents to my kid. I didn't need saving or white knighting, but I caved to that pressure. And I think a part of me also married that person because my mom and dad were fooled by his masks. And I think it kind of worried them still that, you know, I was a single parent and they wanted the best for their grandchild. And so I think I thought, I can make the best of this. I can make the best of this. And he kept his mask up around my child. But when my child went west for their education out of high school, it just little by little, he just became nastier and nastier. And I kept thinking, oh, it's the stress at work. No, there's a reason I'm ex-wife number three. And that was a red flag for me because he never would talk about him. And I knew something was off. But God, if I can say anything to the viewers, listen to your gut. If you're dating someone and it feels off, politely, safely, just end it and move on. Because, my God, they're hard to get away when they've got you ensnared in their world of controlling, gaslighting, horrible stuff. And he was actually very scary to get away. I had to have an order for protection and tell him in a public restaurant, and he got booted from the house immediately. I had the house. We co-owned and we're joint and everything. I had the house from July of last year to April when it sold by myself. He just sat up there hiding with his sisters while I got the house ready to sell, and he just made his 50%. And, you know, karma's going to be his thing. Karma and the justice of higher powers, I know will take care of them. And that's why I'm staying out of the courts, and I'm just doing something like this to release it. Let people know. Share the video with anybody and everybody if it can help somebody. And give them hope.
Let me ask you one last question.
Yeah.
What would you say to this guy that you were babysitting for, if you could talk to him now, or if he's watching this video?
I hope it finds him. My first words would be rotten hell. Rotten hell. Rotten hell, and you better not be touching your grandchildren's babysitters. This is rotten hell. I don't know how many young girls he molested. Yeah, I don't think I have anything else, just rotten hell. And, you know, I was raised in a church, and I shouldn't say that, I suppose, but that's my gut feeling. And the town and the community needs to stop protecting that person and the wife who enabled it and brought us in knowing her husband was a predator, she can go to hell with him because that's not right. And they're still married and they're still acting like everything's fine and that none of this happened. And as I said, I have no idea how many other girls there were. And that breaks my heart more than anything. Because I don't know if I was the first, but I do still feel like if I had not been so convinced that he would hurt somebody and I had been braver, I could have spared some other girls from going through what I went through. Then, and who knows, he might have been more aggressive. I might have emboldened him if I was his first. I don't know. But then I know from personal experience that those girls that followed me and were victim of his, I know they've surely been struggling like me. Because you think you're okay, like I said. And life can, from outward appearances, appear to be together and good. But then something triggers it. And something, you're right back in it. And even recently, when I was kind of practicing for this video, I was remembering things from my high school years and his abuse that I hadn't even remembered. So, but I want people to know you can survive it, but you got to get the therapy and you got to take care of yourself. And even when it's scary, you eventually got to start talking about it. You got to get it out of you, because if you keep it all inside and you hold their secrets, that's when it eats you up. It just eats you up. So I'm giving it to you. You put it out there. And yes, I do hope the video finds him, because he should be nervous. He should be afraid. I've chosen not to come after him in the courts because I don't want to waste my time or energy or money on that. But I hope he finds this video. Honestly, I'm not going to share it directly, but I know it'll be passed around. And that's part of my healing. I've got it out. I'm going to go float in my pool now. And I'm going to go back to my beautiful home and my pets. And I'm going to start my therapy with somebody who is really good and qualified at working with, you know, someone with my history. And I'm just going to keep healing and keep painting and keep watching the birds and the mammals and
right.
Praying and trying to stay positive. And thank God I had good parents and a fabulous childhood, because that was my foundation that's kept me solid. And I speak to them all the time and I pray to Mom and Dad. And I even said before I came in, Mom and Dad, I got this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to tell the story. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to get this off of my chest and just share it, tears and all. That's it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.